Will the clerk call the first case, please?
3220249 consolidated with 3220250 for oral argument. The people of the state of Illinois, appellee versus Carolyn J. S. Appellant.
Ms. Spahn, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Laurel Spahn, and I'm an attorney with the Legal Advocacy Service of the Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission, representing the respondent appellant, Ms. Carolyn J. S. May it please the court. I'd like to talk with you about three different things. First, I'd like to talk about the commitment order in this matter. Then I'd like to turn to the medication order. And then if there's time, I would like to talk about why, if either order is reversed in these two appeals, the other order should be reversed. So turning to the commitment order, the substantive issue here is whether a mid-trial order motion to amend, what the trial judge called a late hour motion to amend, was appropriate here. And the argument is that it was not, and that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge to allow it. And what we argue in the appellant's brief is that there is no automatic right to amend, and that the case law provides for four factors to look at to determine whether it's appropriate to allow an amendment. And the four factors include whether there needs to be a cure for a defective pleading, whether there is surprise or prejudice, and the last two factors are sort of interconnected, whether the amendment is timely and whether there were other opportunities to amend. And in this case, our brief explains how each of those factors were not shown here. And in particular, the state admits to surprise here. While in the state's brief, they say the respondent should not have been wholly surprised because there was a kind of a late certificate that was filed in this proceeding that checked off an additional box, an additional cause of action for involuntary admission. But the state is asking the respondent and respondent's counsel to mind read how it intends to proceed in the case. And it's not a certificate that litigants rely on. It's the pleading in the matter. So I would turn now to the medication case and point out that there are just so many, many things wrong with that medication proceeding. And those are all addressed in the appellant's brief. There was the use of the form petition, which is fine to use a form petition, but you can't just allege legal conclusions. And that's always been the rule in Illinois. Illinois is a fact pleading state. The state admits that its pleading was defective from the outset. There was a second petition filed. That amended petition was filed just without leave of court, without mentioning it during the trial, without a motion to amend. That petition was also just alleging legal conclusions. So those petitions were defective. And the state has a specific duty under Section 3-101 of the Mental Health Code to ensure that pleadings and orders are properly prepared in these cases. The order for hearing that was prepared by the state in this matter, it's the same in that same order. That was the order appointing counsel for the respondent. So that order was just fully on the state. That same order set the hearing with only 2 days' notice, and the statutory required minimum notice for an involuntary medication proceeding is 3 days' notice. So that's a big problem there. The order for medication that was ultimately entered included tests and procedures where the state's expert testified those are not necessary. And the trial court made no findings about those tests and procedures, but those were included in the order. So, I mean, that's just dreadful. And the order otherwise does not match the testimony. As explained in the respondent appellant's brief, the testimony was basically a mishmash of the two petitions that were filed in this matter. It wasn't until the testimony where any of the parties, I think, learned what the doctor's intended treatment plan was. And the treatment included medications that the respondent testified she had had negative reactions to before. So I would turn now to the third thing I wanted to talk about, which is if one of the orders is reversed, the other should be reversed. That goes for both orders. This court, some years ago, decided the John N. case. In that case, this court said, if a commitment order is reversed, then a concurrent medication order should be reversed because the medication order is dependent on the respondent being in the inpatient facility. Now, based on that same reasoning, we're asking this court to apply that John N. reasoning if this court reverses the involuntary medication order in this case. If the court reverses the involuntary medication order in this case, this court should apply that John N. reasoning and reverse the involuntary commitment order here. Let me explain why. The involuntary commitment order here is only based on that prong three, or as DuPage County refers to it, box three criterion for commitment. That's the very broad commitment criterion, which we're not saying the person has a mental illness and because of that mental illness they are at risk of inflicting harm on self or others. We're not saying that the person has a mental illness and because of that mental illness they're unable to provide for their basic physical needs. Ms. Carolyn J.S. was only found subject to commitment on that third allegation, which is a person with mental illness who refuses treatment or is not adequately adhering to prescribed treatment, and because of the nature of their illness is unable to understand the need for treatment, and if not treated on an inpatient basis is reasonably expected to have deterioration and then meet either that criterion of harm to self or others or inability to provide for basic needs. And what the doctor said here was, he said that treatment in this situation, the treatment that he wanted Ms. Carolyn J.S. to have was enforced medications. That's on page RI-103 of the record on appeal here. So we get to the point where if the medication order is reversed in this now consolidated appeal for oral argument, then the commitment order should be reversed because without the treatment order, then there's no reason to hold this person who is not currently harmful and who has not been found unable to provide for her basic physical needs. That's applying the John N. logic to a commitment order. I'm sorry, am I making your head hurt? Holdridge.
I'm trying to, when you're talking about box three, okay, You're saying that the only reason for her involuntary admission is to receive treatment. Am I correct? Is that too simple a statement?
That was the only reason she was found subject to involuntary admission. It was the 119 subsection 3 criterion for inpatient admission. Specifically, the current petition alleged both harm and needs. And then there was that mid-trial motion to amend saying, wait a minute, we want to go forward on this very broad allegation and say that she is refusing or not adequately adhering to treatment. And we want to be able to allege that she needs commitment for that reason. Granted, she wasn't prescribed any medication. That's in the record too. The doctor had been asking her about medication and she said, no, thank you. But the doctor quickly whipped up a new certificate and said, let's try to commit her for that reason. But yes, she was only committed for that reason. If you look at the order that was entered, she was not found subject to commitment on any other basis. And the state gave up their harm allegation that was originally alleged in the petition. So the state proceeded on basic needs. The state gave up the harm allegation and then added over the objection of Ms. Carolyn J.S.'s counsel when that oral motion was made. They added that third cause of action.
Okay, unravel for me basic needs.
I'm sorry?
Unravel basic needs. You're using in other words, there's a ground for commitment because of basic needs.
Yes, basic needs is when you are not able to, if you may not be taking care of your food, shelter, needs, basic needs, so that you may ultimately cause serious harm to yourself. It's like self-neglect. It means self-neglect. So the judge did not find self-neglect in her case. The trial court committed her only on that newly added in the middle of trial.
Newly added grounds. What are they?
The newly added grounds were section 1-119(3) of the Mental Health Code. And that's a very, very broad category or criterion for involuntary admission. It says a person may be subject to involuntary inpatient commitment if they have a mental illness and they are refusing treatment or not adhering adequately to prescribed treatment. And because of the nature of their illness, they are unable to understand the need for treatment. And if not treated on an inpatient basis, they are reasonably expected, based on their behavioral history, to suffer mental or emotional deterioration and are reasonably expected after such deterioration to either become harmful to self or others or unable to meet their basic physical needs. So,
I apologize, Justice Mann. Ms. Spahn, you have said a couple times that you were surprised about this, that this happened in the middle, et cetera. But you knew Dr. Wang's opinion the day before that it was under box 2 and box 3, correct?
Well, I was not the trial counsel, but the trial counsel, according to the record, was emailed a copy of that certificate the morning of the trial. Now, the certificates under the Mental Health Code, two certificates are required. There's no requirement for multiple certificates. And there was a first certificate. There was a second certificate of psychiatrist as required within 24 hours. Then when the respondent was transferred to the mental health campus of Edwards Elmhurst, Dr. Wang did a certificate. That was on, she came on the like at 11 o'clock at night on March 14th. Within 24 hours, like within 5 minutes, there was an examination. Within 24 hours, there was an examination by a psychiatrist. So that would have been on March 15th. Later on March 15th, she was transferred to the mental health campus. Dr. Wang did a certificate on March 16th. Then on March, Then on March 23rd, Dr. Wang did a new certificate, but there's no provision for all of these certificates. Dr. Wang's certificate doesn't add anything new in his explanation. There's just a different box checked. We don't know that the trial attorney got that email the morning of trial. There was no indication that anybody wanted to amend the petition to change the allegations in the petition or to change the cause of action. If I had been the trial counsel and I had received that email, I don't know that I would have even noticed there was a second box checked, because there weren't any opinions there. There wasn't any conclusions there to indicate why the doctor was suddenly checking a different box. But it's the pleading that matters here. It's not a certificate that we're moving forward on. So when the trial counsel in this case first heard questions related to that 119.3 criterion, the trial counsel said, I'm not sure why these questions are being asked. That's irrelevant. So we don't know that the trial counsel ever saw that certificate in his email box. There wasn't any, excuse me one second. I see the red light is on. Do you want me to finish this thought?
Yeah, if you could just finish this one thought, please. You'll have time in reply.
I'm sorry?
You'll have time in reply.
Okay, well.
But finish that last thought. I'll let you do that, please.
Okay. There is no suggestion that there was any other communication with this certificate, that there was going to be a request to add an additional cause of action. So we can't expect the trial counsel to surmise or mind read how the state is going to proceed when this is just emailed the morning of trial. It's the pleading that counts.
The questions from the court? Any questions?
Just there was one with regard to the appointment of the attorney. This was not the day before, but it was very shortly before the hearing. Is that not correct?
The order appointing the counsel?
No, just the appointment of the attorney to represent the respondent.
The appointment of the counsel to represent the respondent in the medication case occurred 2 days before the hearing. It was the same order that set the trial for 2 days before, with the lack of the proper statutory notice, 2 days before the medication trial.
So in addition to not having notice, she also didn't have much time because she was just appointed the 2 days before the hearing.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Any? Okay. You'll have time in reply, Ms. Bond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Prindle, you may respond.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and may it please the court. Trevor Prindle, Assistant State's Attorney for DuPage County on behalf of the people in these two consolidated matters. I just want to lay down some background really quickly. I know it started to get a little flushed out at the end of Ms. Spahn's argument, but as to exactly what occurred on a timeline here. Respondent in this matter was brought to Elmhurst Hospital on March 14th, 2022, and a petition was then filed on March 15th, 2022, the next day, which alleged that the respondent was subject to involuntary admission on an inpatient basis pursuant to the criteria in section 119.1, which was a danger to self or others, and section 119.2, which is the basic needs box that the court and Ms. Spahn had a colloquy about. There was then a certificate that issued from a social worker at Elmhurst, which was consistent with the petition and alleged that the respondent here was subject to involuntary admission based on the criteria in section 119.1 and 119.2. She was then examined by a psychiatrist, Dr. Aldura, again of Elmhurst Hospital, who stated that the respondent was only subject to admission based on that criteria set forth in section 119.2 and 119.2 alone. The respondent was then—
That being?
The inability to care for basic physical needs. Yeah. The respondent was then transported on March 15th, the same day that she had the second certificate issue, to Linden Oaks Hospital in Naperville. At Linden Oaks Hospital, Naperville, on March 16th, the next day, she was evaluated by Dr. Wong, who was then her treating psychiatrist at Linden Oaks Hospital. Dr. Wong then issued the third overall certificate, which alleged only the inability to care for basic physical needs under section 119.2. Dr. Wong continued to be the respondent's treating psychiatrist, and on March 22nd, he re-evaluated the respondent and ultimately issued a fourth overall certificate in this matter, which was then filed later in the afternoon around 3 p.m. on March 23rd, 2022, the day before the two matters proceeded to hearing. In that re-evaluation, Dr. Wong then alleged that the respondent was a person who was subject to involuntary admission on an inpatient basis under that inability to care for basic physical needs under section 119.2, and admittedly for the first time in across all the petition and the certificate, then also alleged that the respondent was subject to that inpatient admission under section 119.3, which in some states that the respondent was somebody who was not adequately adhering to their treatment and was likely to deteriorate to the point where she would meet the criteria if not treated on an inpatient basis in either the danger to self or others or have an inability to care for her basic physical needs.
And what Mr. Prindle, at the time, Mr. Prindle, at the time that she, that this fourth report was done by Dr. Wang on the 22nd. He had been treating her for a week, correct?
Since March 16th. So about a week, six to seven days. And I believe Justice Holdridge had a question.
Yes, I did. What was her treatment?
When I say treatment, I mean that in a more broad sense. Dr. Wang would be meeting with her daily, not likely on the weekends, but he would at least once a day meet with the respondent, try to have conversations regarding
talk her therapy, mental health. Talk therapy, right?
Correct, or one-on-one individual therapy, yes.
Well, that's there are no drugs, there are no medications or whatever.
Correct.
Okay, so it's talk therapy.
Correct.
And from that, he made a diagnosis that she needed chemical therapy.
I don't know if it's fair to say that from those conversations, he made a diagnosis that she needed chemical therapy. It may have been more that based off of the progression of her symptoms and the fact that she was not improving, that then the chemical or involuntary medication was then necessary for the treatment of her mental illness, which ultimately led then to the petition for medications to then be issued on March 22nd.
So he's giving an expert opinion. All this certificate stuff is basically opinion evidence, right?
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay, put it in the context of normal law terms. Okay.
Yeah, and I think it's a point I did want to make in a leading a little bit off of that. Is Ms. Bond in her argument is stating that it's the pleadings that matter and we're not concerned with their certificates, but I don't think that the two can really be divorced from each other. I believe that the petition and the certificates need to be read as a whole in what we're looking at as far as the doctor's opinion and what the basis is for holding somebody in a hospital on an inpatient basis or to have involuntary medications administered. The code does necessitate that two certificates be filed along with a petition, or at least one needs to be filed with the petition if they're going to be in a hospital setting, and then a second one needs to follow shortly thereafter within a reasonable amount of time. And I believe you have to look at then the certificate and what's alleged on the certificate when looking at the pleadings as a whole. Ms. Spahn is correct in pointing at the Freebird factors, although she did not bring up the case name, but in terms of whether or not the court was correct or abused its discretion and whether or not to allow the amendment at trial to have the petition match on its face the four certificate from Dr. Wong, that those four factors outlaid in Freebird, one being, is it curing a defect? Two, is there prejudice or surprise to the respondent? The third, the timeliness. And the fourth, which I do agree goes hand in hand almost with that third one, was there previous opportunities to amend the pleadings? The state here, in seeking to have the petition amended on its face, did cure a defect insofar as the petition did not match Dr. Wong's most up-to-date assessment of the respondent in this matter. The code, as Ms. Bond pointed out, does not allow or have any statement as to whether or not more than two certificates can be filed. But I would like to point out to the court that there's no prohibition against adding on a third or fourth certificate in this case. And the reason that was done was explicitly because there was a continuing reevaluation when she was transferred from Elmhurst Hospital to Linden Oaks and Dr. Wong became her treating psychiatrist. And then over the course of days from March 16th to March 22nd, upon those further meetings with respondent, Dr. Wong's opinion and his basis for alleging that respondent needed to be held involuntarily, likewise had shifted. The prejudice or surprise grounds clearly weighs as to the fact that that fourth certificate was filed very late on March 23rd and the trial proceeded on March 24th. However, as the trial court noted in its denial of respondent's motion to reconsider, there was a copy that was at least the morning of provided to respondent's counsel in this matter. And I do think it is hard to say that there was a complete surprise upon asking for the amendment to the pleading to respondent's counsel that at least Dr. Wong at some point then believed Carolyn met those requirements as outlined in Section 119.3. The timeliness of the amendment, I think, is timely under the Civil Code of Procedure. I'm specifically looking at 735 ILCS 5/2-616, which addresses amendments to pleadings. There was, as the state admitted at the trial level, an oversight in not having the petition amended prior to its oral motion to amend. But along with the whether or not there was a previous opportunity to amend the pleadings in this matter, these mental health cases are very truncated, as evidenced by the filing on March 15th and a hearing on March 24th. And the fourth certificate issuing the day before did leave little time to have that defect cured. In turning to the meds petition, and specifically on some of the arguments raised by Ms. Spahn, the state did confess error as it related to the petition in its brief, and it does still confesses error that the petition in the Mets case did not adhere to the Third District's ruling in In re Marcus S. The state still maintains that mootness does apply to both of these matters, but if this court were to find that there is an exception to mootness, the state would say that the Mets petition should be the order should be vacated and the matter then dismissed based off of that ineffective assistance of counsel, which was initially raised in respondent's brief. Lastly, in Ms. Spahn's point regarding whether or not if this court were to dismiss the medications petition based on that confession of error, if it should also likewise dismiss and reverse and remand on the admissions petition. There was a citing to In re John N., which, as Ms. Spahn stated, a Third District decision, which held that because there was the dismissal of an admissions petition, that the medications petition and order must also fall. I do not think, however, that the reverse is true. If this court were, or if any court were to find that a person was subject to admission, but for whatever reason, either the medication petition is denied at hearing, or an appellate court were to reverse, as it most likely will hear, based off of the confession of error, the state and respondent in this case would still be subject to involuntary admission, and the state could refile a new medications petition to have the treatment provided to respondents. Notably, the respondent in her brief cited to a case In re Troski, Troskic, which did point out a potential lapse where a person could be found subject to involuntary admission but not being treated. But I think, as kind of stated a little bit before, the respondent was still being treated from March 16th of 2022 to up until the point of the hearing via talk therapy. It just was not a medications treatment. And I just would urge the court to find that the In re John N. Rule, as it was called in respondent's brief, does not really stand for the inverse, that just because a medications petition is dismissed, that an admission petition also needs to be dismissed.
Regardless of the cause of the dismissal?
I'm sorry, can you repeat your question?
Regardless of the cause of the dismissal?
Yes, regardless of the cause of the dismissal, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And if there are no more questions from the court, I would just ask that the court affirm the trial court's order denying the motion to reconsider in the admissions petition, and then dismiss the Mets' appeal as moot, or if it's not to find mootness, then to vacate the medication order on that ineffective assistance of counsel grounds.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Prindle.
Thank you.
Ms. Spahn, you may reply. Hope you're muted. There we go. There you are.
Thank you. Sorry about that. One thing I would ask this court to do is to consider the state's important role in these kinds of civil mental health proceedings. You know, respondents in mental health cases are not criminals. Criminal defendants have the right to have the state follow the rules and act fairly in criminal proceedings. And the state should do the same in mental health cases that are civil in nature. There is no other kind of case where a person is going to have a new cause of action thrown at them at the last minute. And that's okay. You know, there is case law from the Fourth District, and it's cited by the Illinois Supreme Court, that says we have allowed mental health cases to be treated differently, and we have to be ever vigilant about that, and to treat these civil mental health cases just as any other case, and to apply the rules. And the case law I'm referring to where that's mentioned is Andrew B. and the Lisa G.C. case. They're citing to the words of Justice Connect from the Fourth District. So I'd ask that this court keep those words in mind. The state says, oops, it made an oversight. It made an oversight. Well, you know, a motion to amend is an important thing. It says, oh, mental health cases are truncated. I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that. I think the state means there are shorter time frames for these hearings because these involve liberty interests, but they're not truncated proceedings. And the state has, under Section 3-800B, the right to, or well, the ability to ask for up to 15 days of continuance. So if they got on the eve of trial a new certificate from their expert saying, wait a minute, I think I want to pursue a different cause of action, then the state under 3-101 should say, doctor, you're changing your mind all of a sudden. It's the eve of trial. For due process, we have to be fair to the respondent, and we need to do a motion to amend. We're going to ask for a continuance. We're going to file that motion to amend because the respondent may have some defenses they want to prepare for this. We can't just do this willy-nilly by emailing a copy of your certificate and nothing else to the respondent and hope they can mind read that you want to change your cause of action at the last minute. So I'd ask you to think about due process, the right to notice, and the important liberty interest at stake here. The trial judge abused his discretion, and the defense counsel here objected when testimony first started coming out about this new cause of action. There was no defective pleading here. There was a cause of action alleging two of the criteria for involuntary admission. And it was not a defect that one box wasn't checked. Three doctors had all observed and evaluated this respondent. Not one checked that third box. It was on the eve of trial, and the doctor suddenly changed course. It was up to the state under 3-101 to do something about that. The state could have asked for a continuance to file a motion to amend. The state had time. Maybe the state is not aware of Section 3-800B saying the court or the state can have up to 15 days of continuance if necessary. Beyond that, it has to be at the respondent's request. But they hadn't used up that many days of continuance. So there was time to cure that if they wanted to add an additional cause of action. But otherwise, the petition was not defective. The state still went forward on that basic needs element, but the judge didn't find it. The respondent testified, I would encourage you to read the record and read what Carolyn J.S. had to say. Carolyn J.S. testified about her understanding of the need for treatment. There was testimony about how she weighs 190 pounds, and the doctor said, you know what? She is somebody who could stand to lose some weight. I'm sorry, I see that my light is on. I would ask the court to reverse these orders. Thank you.
Questions from the court? Further questions?
No.
Oh, okay. Thank you, counsel, both for your arguments on this matter this afternoon. It'll be taken under advisement. Written disposition shall issue. Clerk of our court will escort you now out of our remote courtroom, and we'll proceed with another case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.